coverage by the end of the week. Meanwhile, a series of weak low-pressure systems will track across the Great Lakes, bringing light snow to that region through the end of the week. Highs today will range from the low 30s in northern Indiana to near 50 degrees in western Missouri. Low temperatures overnight will range from the low 20s in northern Wisconsin to the mid-30s in Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon, partly sunny. We'll see a high in the upper 30s. The wind from the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 30. The wind will be from the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny and warmer with a high of 47. The wind from the southwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a chance of rain. We'll see a low in the upper 30s with a wind out of the southwest around 10 miles per hour. Friday, partly sunny with a high in the upper 40s. The wind will be from the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Friday night and Saturday, partly cloudy. Expect a low Friday night in the low 30s and a high Saturday in the upper 40s. Saturday night, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s. Sunday and Sunday night, partly cloudy. The high Sunday in the mid-40s, the low Sunday night in the upper 20s. At noon central time, temperatures across Illinois and Indiana ranged from the upper 20s to the low 40s. We saw a mix of cloud and sun across the two states. At Rockford, 28. Chicago's O'Hare Airport reported 27 degrees. It was 31 at Bloomington. In Mattoon, 35. Carbondale reported 40 degrees. South Bend, 32. Lafayette, 31. It was 33 at Indianapolis, 35 at Terre Haute. Willard Airport reported a partly sunny sky at the top of the hour, the temperature 33. The dew point 26, the relative humidity 75%. The wind out of the west at 7, giving us a wind chill of 27, and the barometric pressure 30.06 and falling, and at 12:39, 33 degrees in Urbana. Goya, the nation's largest Hispanic-owned food company, is celebrating its 75th anniversary.
Si es Goya, tiene que ser bueno.
If it's Goya, it has to be good.
The privately held company started out as a single store in Manhattan. Today it has 2,000 different products from coconut juice to beans. The company has grown along with the country's Hispanic population. So Goya's story tells us something about how the nation is changing demographically. Charlie Herman of WNYC in New York City reports on how the company built its business and where it's headed.
Like any successful business, Goya has to offer what its customers want. And that means understanding that sometimes a bean is not just a bean.
In Mexico, there will be pinto, then it's frijol pinto. The Dominican Republic will be habichuela pinta.
Robert Unanue is the president of Goya Foods and is the third generation of his family to run the privately held company. At the headquarters in Secaucus, New Jersey, he flips through a 500-page coffee table-sized book chronicling Goya's history.
It's a story of not only of the company or the family, but it's a story of Spanish immigration.
Robert's grandfather, Prudencio, immigrated from Spain and founded the company in Lower Manhattan. He sold Spanish-made food products to his fellow immigrants. But in 1936, when the Spanish Civil War made importing from that country impossible, Prudencio sold sardines from Morocco labeled Goya. He liked the name, bought it for a dollar, and the company was born.
He built the company on the immigrant community coming into the United States.
And as more Spanish-speaking immigrants came to this country, from Cuba, Puerto Rico, Central and South America, Goya grew along with them. Sales are now more than $1 billion a year. But it's not just the surge in the Hispanic population that accounts for its success.
We have a saying here, you know, we're united by language, we're separated by the bean.
To explain this more clearly, Goya veteran Joseph Perez, who oversees sales and marketing, walks amidst the stacks of tropical-flavored drinks and jars of olives and points to one can of beans.
Here we have a black bean puree called frijoles volteados. Volteados means flipped. It's from Central America. What makes it different than other beans? It is totally pureed. It is not a refried bean that's chunky. This is as if the difference between chunky peanut butter and smooth peanut butter. Central Americans want it smooth, as opposed to the Mexican version, which would be chunky.
It's not only knowing the differences, but it's making sure that can of beans is in the right store, in the right neighborhood. To do that, Goya, unlike many of its competitors, still delivers direct to stores, especially those corner groceries known as bodegas. Bert Flickinger is a retail analyst with Strategic Resource Group.
Every store can have a different assortment. So if it's people from the Caribbean and you have Dominican consumers in one neighborhood and two blocks away, Cuban consumers, Goya will have a slightly different assortment for preferences for consumers from different Caribbean countries.
That leads to a higher turnover of its products on the shelves and higher profits for the company. Like any family-run business, Goya's had its share of internal strife. Family members have even battled each other in court, but it survived and the company continues to grow. It's opening a cannery in Texas with 150 new employees. It's planning to build a new multi-million dollar headquarters in New Jersey. And it's even considering expanding operations in Mexico. For NPR News, I'm Charlie Herman.
A nationwide effort to find a once popular catalog product has hit a milestone. As Jenna Dooley reports, the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency has good reason to be excited.
Think of it as the IKEA at the turn of the 19th century. Rural small business owners could order pieces of ornamental sheet metal from catalogs to spruce up the facades of their shops. The materials arrived in boxes with instructions, and it was a do-it-yourself job from there. The catalogs and materials were from the Mesker family, and the buildings became known as Meskers.
It's not that other materials weren't available. It's just that given the rapid growth of American cities and also rebuilding of cities after the Civil War, there needed to be a certain hierarchy of building materials based on cost. And Mesker simply marketed themselves as the more affordable, and they actually used the word cheap.
That's Darius Brica, former Illinois Historic Preservation Agency employee and now a consultant. He began the Mesker identification effort with the state in May 2005. According to the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency, there are now just over 2,000 buildings that make up the Mesker database. More than a third of them are in Illinois. That's because the Mesker brothers split to form two competing companies, one in St. Louis and one in Evansville, Indiana, with the land of Lincoln squarely in the middle. Brica and preservationists have added to the database, which has grown steadily in the past 6.5 years.
We estimate that there were over 50,000 of them nationwide. So sitting at around 2,000 is but a fraction of what originally was, and we'll never get to the original number simply because many buildings have been lost. But I think it's feasible that the number of identified buildings could double in the future.
The fate of Meskers, once common, is a mixed bag. The Mesker offerings fell out of popularity by 1920. While some buildings were demolished, others have received star treatment. The Masonic Office Building in Geneva, Illinois, is a good example of the latter. The building's owners are continuously maintaining the historic facade. Carla Kalfus is the preservation planner for Geneva. She says the owner's dedication is good for the entire downtown, especially in recent years as shop owners across the country flee to the suburbs in favor of new construction.
What we always see in the preservation circles is that if one owner improves their building and repairs something and paints it, it really encourages that neighbor to maintain their building in a similar way. And so I think that's what we see here in Geneva is that property owners really are respective of their properties, and they continue to maintain their buildings knowing that that's the marketing for the city and for their spot as well.
The Geneva building has retail shops on the lower level with Masonic Temple offices on the upper floor. Light-hued paint highlights a decorative cornice and floral patterns throughout the facade. Kalfus says if kept up, the Meskers age well despite their low initial cost. Other Meskers in the northern Illinois area include two storefronts in downtown Rock Falls, the Masonic Building in Rochelle, and Austin Flats in Woodstock. Meskers have a unique place in Midwestern architectural history, and preservationists want to keep these gems from becoming rare.
Now, looking back, we can see what quality these were just from an architecture standpoint. They really have helped to boost buildings' appearances.
I'm Jenna Dooley.
A former church in the Quad Cities will soon reopen as a museum for historic documents. Rock Island is the newest location for the Karpeles Manuscript Library Museums. Herb Trix reports.
Based in Santa Barbara, California, the Karpeles family has been collecting historic documents and manuscripts for decades. And in the early 80s, they began opening museums around the country to display their collections. Rock Island is number 12, with others located in New York, South Carolina, Florida, Indiana, and Washington. Christopher Kelly is director of the Karpeles Museum in Buffalo, New York.
The beauty of the collection is that there really is no rhyme or reason to it. There are 5,000-year-old clay tablets all the way up to Harry Potter-related items, and it's certainly an awful lot of items in between. It's the largest private collection in the world. Over 1 million pieces in our collection. It's still growing.
So why aren't these documents held in government archives or museums?
You know, the working copy of the Emancipation Proclamation Amendment to the Constitution, we own that. A draft copy of the original Constitution of the United States, we own that as well. And the reason that we do is fairly simple. We acquired them. And keep in mind also that the National Archives, I guess the de facto clearinghouse for government documents, really it was not established until 1933. So conceivably anything produced before then, it could be fair game in the open market.
Karpeles is what Kelly calls a display institution. Each museum has 25 display cases, and each rotating exhibit uses 25 display cases, so they're easy to move and easy to replace. One recent example is a collection of documents on spiritualism.
Focuses primarily on the writings of Arthur Conan Doyle, but not on his famous writings, not his Sherlock Holmes-related items, but his writings on the field of spiritualism, which he lectured extensively throughout the United States on. In addition to the Conan Doyle items, we also have a number of Harry Houdini items that go along with this display because they were intellectual rivals around the field of spiritualism.
He says the first exhibit in the new Rock Island Karpeles Museum will be about Mark Twain, including many of his personal letters.
We were the first to publish a Mark Twain story. Mark Twain was a big fan of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, and he decided to publish his own version of that piece, which at the time in the late 19th century was just far too risque for his publisher to handle. So it remained unpublished until we went ahead and published it in the early 1980s. Oh, the theatrical version of Adventures of Huck Finn will have a few of those items on display too.
Besides David and Marcia Karpeles, Kelly says other well-known document collectors include Ross Perot and the late Malcolm Forbes. And there's also competition from other museums, libraries, and universities.
It never ceases to amaze me what a private individual can own given the appropriate timing and resources.
The Christian Science Church in Rock Island was built in 1915, but it's been vacant for the last 15 years and is on the list of local historic landmarks. I'm Herb Trix.
Always wanted to visit Cuba? Well, now you can. Explore the cultural and historic treasures of Cuba with WILL. Enjoy a 9-day journey beginning May 13th, 2012. We'll depart from central Illinois, flying into Miami and on to Trinidad and Havana. Space is limited to 30, and the deadline to register is February 1st.